Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for the 18th of December 2013. And joining me for this edition are games editor Mark Botwright.
Let's make lemonade.
News editor Mark Hodgkinson.
I'm the dude playing the dude, disguised as another dude.
And audio reviewer Ed Selly.
A hooker. Oh, Jesus, you killed a hooker.
Right, well, welcome to the penultimate podcast for this year. And as happens often at this time of year, people are dropping like flies. We've had, Antonia Bird died recently, director. We had Lewis Collins, who died recently. And of course, more recently, Paul Walker died tragically in a car crash. And then yesterday, Peter O'Toole popped his clogs at the ripe old age of 81, although in all honesty, he's lucky to have made it that old, really. I mean, he had stomach cancer in the 70s and they had to remove most of his stomach. And he was a notorious boozer, so I think 81 is actually a pretty good innings for Peter O'Toole. Obviously, best remembered for playing Lawrence of Arabia in Lawrence of Arabia. Although, you know, he is actually nominated for 8 Academy Awards as Best Actor. Never won. He has the dubious record of being the most nominations without actually winning one. Thoughts, gentlemen, on Peter O'Toole and his legacy?
To be clear, I mean, obviously, I love Lawrence of Arabia. I think his portrayal of T. Lawrence is actually pretty good. But my first experience of Peter O'Toole was actually not him himself. Yeah, there's a spitting image sketch from the 1980s with the puppets of him and Oliver Reed. And they're talking to each other on the after a big night out, you know, such as their proclivities during the time. And it sort of leads back to the fact that Oliver Reed had given Peter O'Toole a sex change operation because he fancied a quickie. And it was like, once I was Peter O'Toole, now I'm Peter bloody No-Toole. And unfortunately, ever since then, absolutely everything I've watched of his has been me going, yeah, Peter No-Toole. But no. He did do some fabulous films. I didn't realise he'd be nominated that many times. I dare say that at the rate he's going, it's possible that Mr. DiCaprio might be able to eclipse a number of nominations without wins. But we'll see how we go. I mean, at the very least, unlike Mr. Walker, 81 years, he lived a fairly lively 81 years, yeah. And I don't think he has. I don't think he went with too many regrets, if I'm honest.
No, he had a very full life, I'd have said, to be honest, if he can remember any of it, which I doubt. The 70s and the 80s are particularly memorable for him. And I can also testify that he does indeed have a tool, because I've seen him in Caligula, where he's bollock naked.
I was going to say, that was my first experience, funnily enough.
What a lasting impression that must have made.
Quite a movie. Didn't they give him an honorary Oscar or something?
Yeah, they did. They gave him an honorary one as well, but that doesn't really count. That's not.
No, of course not.
And that's when like the consolation prize for falling over in the sack race, isn't it?
Well, no, it's basically a prize for still being alive, which was basically the point he made when he accepted it. He said, I'm not retiring yet. Why have you given me this? I think, to be honest, he's absolutely amazing in Lawrence of Arabia. He was a wonderful choice. I mean, in what was effectively his big screen debut. He just had such screen presence, those piercing blue eyes and with that suntan skin and the white robes were just absolutely mesmerizing. I thought his performance was fantastic. He really brought a level of danger and frankly, insanity to Lawrence that was probably appropriate. And he's been great in other things too. But I would say that there is a degree of, you know, certainly a school of thought would suggest that he perhaps didn't live up to his potential in some respects. Maybe the boozing and the hell raising and hanging out with Richard Burton and Richard Harris. I mean, that must have been a hell of a night out with those two. Maybe he didn't quite live up to his potential as a great actor that he could have been, and metaphorically and quite literally pissed it up the wall.
Crappy film as well.
Oh, he did some terrible stuff. He was always up. But thing is, even though the films were terrible, he was usually pretty good in them, yeah. Or at least always interesting.
I think in a strange way, he was one of those actors who perhaps came along at the tail end of when the kind of like large grand scale epics. I think he would have fitted in very well, perhaps in perhaps 10 years earlier, that kind of thing. Because when you see something like Lawrence of Arabia, you realise that he it was quite an iconic image. You know, he worked very well in that kind of film. But then you look at the rest of his career and it did kind of bounce around a lot. You know, you wonder how much of it is entirely attributable to drink. You know, it's very easy for people to say, oh, well, he spent most of X decade drunk or something, and that's why, you know, certain films were made. But again, looking at some of the award nominations. It is a little bit criminal that he didn't get an Academy Award, particularly for Lawrence of Arabia, because was it Gregory Peck beat him To Kill a Mockingbird?
To Kill a Mockingbird, yeah. I think that's
the kind of general Oscars giving it for perhaps, you know, best film or most liked film, as opposed to the best leading performance, because Gregory Peck is basically Gregory Peck in that film.
Gregory Peck's Gregory Peck in every film he ever did.
Yeah, exactly.
Lawrence Arabia won a boatload of Oscars, best film, best director. I think it won 7 in total. But for some reason, maybe because he was overshadowed by Lean to a certain degree, I'm not quite sure why, but you're right, I think he should have won that year. I think it was a mesmerizing performance from him, and you know, in what is a vast, huge, epic movie, and he's in almost every frame of it. You know, you've got to say he carried that movie on his shoulders, and he was 23, I think, at the time. So, certainly in his mid-20s, he wasn't very old.
And he had a long career on the stage as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, absolutely. You know,
his kind of big impact was. I mean, I only saw it on TV, but if you ever see the Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell, is, you know, absolutely fantastic. It's a kind of tour de force.
He had enough experience in that department.
I was going to say he had a great insight there.
Apparently, on stage he was quite variable. He could be awesome one night and then obviously drunk as a lord and terrible the next. I'm pretty sure he's absolutely hammered in a Caligula. And at least that he's got an excuse. I don't know what Malcolm McDowell, Helen Mirren, and John Gilgan have to say about the subject, but he's clearly absolutely bollocksed in Caligula, mad as a hatter. I actually met him once. I met him once at a cricket match, and he was bonkers. He was bonkers. Just kept shouting out Bishop Eddy all the time. He was just a madman, but a great actor, and sorely missed, I think.
Sorely pissed.
And also dying yesterday, a coincidence, I assume, was Joan Fontaine, who was the ripe old age of...
You assume? Are we back to conspiracy theories?
A suicide pact or something like that.
Conspiracy theory.
It was Joan Fontaine, who died at the ripe old age of 96. Now, Joan Fontaine, whose real name is Joan de Havilland, is obviously the sister of Olivia de Havilland, who is still alive. She's the eldest sister. She's still alive at 97. Famously, the two of them didn't get on at all, and in fact haven't spoken since 1975. I'm assuming the reason they're so old is because both of them were desperately trying to outlive the other. But Joan Fontaine, most famous for playing the second Mrs. De Winter in Rebecca being the only Hitchcock film that ever won an Oscar for Best Picture. And I have to say, I absolutely love Rebecca. I think it's a great movie, and she's very, very good in it. Partly because apparently Olivier bullied her something terribly on the set, because he was pissed off that she got the part instead of Vivian Leigh, who was his wife at the time. And that kind of insecurity was played on by Hitchcock. Who basically used, because in the film, Rebecca, now she plays a very insecure character, and I think he used that to her advantage, and it's a great performance. She got nominated for an Oscar for that. Didn't win, but she also did Suspicion the following year, again with Hitchcock and Cary Grant, and that one, she did win the Best Actress Oscar before her sister did, although her sister then won 2 later on. Some people suggest just to try and top her sister for winning the first one. And in fact, she has the unique position of being the only actor to ever win an Oscar in a Hitchcock movie. So thoughts on Joan Fontaine, gentlemen? And don't say who.
Well, I know who she is now.
She also in Suspicion?
Yeah, that's why I just said that. She won an Oscar for Suspicion.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't listening to you.
You were eating, weren't you?
No one was listening, Steve.
No, I think everyone was just spending the time thinking, who's Joan Fontaine?
Quick to the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
It's I'm sure, a great loss, although I imagine that she hasn't been the most prolific.
No, Ed, she hasn't made a feature film since Hammer Horror's The Witches in 1966.
Right, yes. So, do you know what? I do believe that the world of cinema will probably muddle through without her. But, you know, it is obviously a shame that she's gone.
About time, really. 96. Come on, sir. I'd rather be dead by it.
Oh, well, do you want to take bets on how long Olivia de Havilland lasts now that Joan's popped the clogs?
A week.
But it is sad, though, that she probably will be one of those people remembered as the also death, which, you know, the kind of Molly Sugden type, you know, on this day as well as Peter O'Toole. You know, she'll turn up as a pointless question in 10 years.
That happened to Mark Bolan. He died on the same day as an opera singer. His name off Maria Callas. He died the same day as Maria Callas. So So yeah, he sometimes gets forgotten the day he died because of that. And also, I think the week before Elvis died, so that kind of overshadowed Bolan's death. But the moral of the story is: don't get in a Mini when your girlfriend's driving and hits a tree.
I think don't get in any car that hits a tree. I think that's fairly safe advice.
Yeah, but a great loss to the world of music, I think.
He did some great things musically, but let's face it: Mark Bolan earns immortality because he called his son Roland.
Roland Bowie.
Yeah. But, you know, Bowie has immortality as well, ish. But, yeah, that's. I mean, I've got to be honest, Steve, I'm doing my best, you know, muting microphones and stuff. I'm trying to fend a large, elderly, smelly cat away from my microphone for large portions of the time when you're talking. And I have to admit that he's taking up as much of my concentration as Joan Fontaine is. So that, well, that also explains
some of that. That's unfortunate, Ed, because I'm about to make you do a lot of talking.
Well, that's fine. I've moved him a little bit further away now, so okay, we're good.
Fine. So let's move on to the hardware news. And kicking things off, it is Mr. Selly talking about the headphones of the year. So, Ed, what will be your headphones of the year?
Well, the piece is up. I, like Lloyd Grossman, deliberated, cogitated and digested. Four headphones this year really stood out. From a total, I think it's about 16 that we did in total, or rather I did, not a royal we. Three over ears, one in ear. I deliberately didn't place one of them as my absolute favourite because I thought I'd probably mention it in this piece. Of those four, all four of them are excellent, incidentally. But the headphone that stood out for me this year, simply the best combination of lovely build, beautiful looks, incredibly flexible, very, very capable design, is the Sennheiser Momentum. I'm not going to pretend that £260 is an absolute bargain, but neither is it unreasonably expensive. And for that, you get a pair of headphones which look smart, but also, I mean, I speak actually, on the day this podcast goes out, I will be 33. And I didn't feel ridiculous wearing them out and about. I think they look smart. And you know, without being overly showy, they're beautifully made and they sound excellent. The only thing I will say, I won't give too much away, is that on the day that I finished that piece, the last pair of headphones I will review this year turned up. And let's just say that they probably would have made this piece if they turned up earlier in the year, and it will be an interesting one and a decision I haven't yet reached as to whether they might topple it. So do stay tuned for that, because these have come from nowhere.
So that's the Momentums. What were the other nominations on your list?
Well, the other headphones, for a more sort of value perspective, Grado's SR60i, which you can currently buy for £80. And there's
That's exceptionally good value, I think, isn't it? £80 for the Grado?
Stupidly good value. There is nothing that, provided that you're not bothered about leaking a bit of noise when you're using them, because they are open backed and they don't hide that. There's nothing in audio terms you can buy for £80 which is going to give you more musical satisfaction than that. Focal's Spirit Classic. Another very fashionably brown headphone, but also a very, very good one as well. And then the only in-ears this year that made the cut were the Finals from Japan, the Heaven 4. Just a beautifully worked out, beautifully realised and fantastic sounding pair of earphones. Not desperately cheap at £170, but equally you can spend a lot more than that and get a pair of earphones that aren't as good. So all four of those, I mean, if you have left your Christmas shopping this late, I pity you. But nonetheless, if you were suddenly looking for something to do, they are worth considering. And all four of them, considering it, look at your requirements. There should be something for most requirements there. You won't go wrong with any of them.
Excellent. Right. Thank you, Ed. And many happy returns for Wednesday.
Oh, thank you.
You old git.
That's all.
Mark. You've also been looking at, obviously this is the end of the year, so we're looking at products of the year, and you did the TVs of the year. Now, was your article in any particular order?
No orders.
Okay, just checking.
No, I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because people have varying tastes, and plus I didn't see them all these ones on the list, so it's kind of a collective.
I have.
We discuss. Yes, I know. No, rub it in. We collectively discussed it, didn't we? It's a collective decision, this one. And no particular order, because it's been quite a year, isn't it? 2013 TVs, with never so much variety, really, with the emergence of 4K, OLED even. and obviously we have the existing LED and plasma technologies. So we've seen a wide array of tellies this year. The one I chose first on the list, just because it's goodbye, it was the ZT65 or ZT60 if you're listening from other areas, the Panasonic plasma.
Or even ZT if you're in the States.
Or the ZT, yeah, if you like. No, I don't like that. They build it as beyond the reference. Maybe that was a little bit of a lofty claim, but it was certainly at the video files, a video file grade panel, only in 60 inches, which was perhaps a bit of a limitation.
Well, only in 60 inches in this country, but there was a 65 inch available in the States.
True. And yeah, it was, what can you say about it? Excellent black levels, lovely motion, great video processing, a reasonably attractive TV. You know, it's just all the strength of plasma that we've grown to love over the years, and it just sort of epitomised in one final panel from Panasonic. But we should also mention the VT65, GT60, and ST60 as honourable mentions, because they pushed it pretty close.
They did, yeah. I mean, I think across the board, their plasmas this year were, I mean, they did save the best till last.
And, they did.
And they were all excellent. Absolutely. I mean, the GT offers staggering value for performance in terms of performance. The VT has the 65-inch panel as well. And just as, no, I don't want to, I know you think people say size does matter, but that 5-inch difference, yeah, huge in terms of surface area. Yeah, when you put it next to one another, it's a massive difference.
Yeah, and even the ST was great. I mean, you could calibrate that up to look very close to all the rest of them. So, fantastic way to end their association with plasma. And then I just arbitrarily went to LED. It was kind of chronological if you look at it, actually, this. So, we went to the LED LCD 1080p panel, which we decided was the Sony W905.
Yes, we did.
Which I think you saw, which is...
I saw that one, and I think we discussed this in previous podcasts that for a number of years, Sony have been coasting on their old reputation and perhaps have dropped the ball slightly. But in the last 2 years, they've definitely picked up the pace, raised the game, and delivered some really cracking TVs. And last year, we didn't get the flagship TV this country. For some
but the one below it was pretty good. I saw that one.
Was very, you saw that one.
I was impressed with that. That was definitely, that was probably my LED of last year if we hadn't done the same exercise.
And the W905 this year I thought was absolutely stonking television. I thought it was really well designed, really well thought out, beautiful picture quality, great blacks for an LED LCD television, good image accuracy, uniformity, and the local dimming was excellent. It was a really cracking, I mean, I'm not, as I'm sure most people know, neither you or I are massive fans of LED LCD. We'd probably prefer plasma if you have the option. But if I was going to have an LED LCD TV, that would be it.
Yeah, I think me too. Which brings us onto the next one, which is also an LED, but a 4K. I think we both agreed this was the 4K TV of the year. So this is the Samsung F9000. You saw the 55, I saw the 65. We were both very impressed with the excellent screen uniformity, the dimming system. Well, I've not seen the Sony one, so I can't directly compare it, but it was the best dimming system I've seen ever, full stop.
Yeah, it was very impressive.
Incredibly also, accurate. Yeah.
I liked the fact that it had the One Connect box, which means
the One Connect box was great.
Upgrade option.
Yeah.
When things change. And this is something that I didn't realize until yesterday when I finally got a chance to see the 55-inch X9, the Sony 4K TV, because certainly on the 65-inch models, there's really not much in it between the Samsung and the Sony. They're both excellent. Obviously, the difference is that the Sony uses passive 3D, which is awesome on a 4K television. I think you've recently seen that yourself and can appreciate now what I've been talking about, whereas the Samsung uses active shutter. However, on the 55-inch model, the Samsung is still using active shutter, which is fine. The Sony, they couldn't make the alternating polarized lines on the filter.
The FBR.
They couldn't make them small enough.
Oh, really?
That size. So it is, and people have been talking about this on the forums, and I could see it for myself. There is quite visible line structure. It's not 1080p per an eye.
Right.
Which kind of marks that one down slightly. I mean, it still looked great, don't get me wrong here. And we've talked about this before about how, really you don't tend to notice the difference in resolution. But it's just a shame that because of the screen size, they couldn't do what they did with the 65-inch.
Yeah,
and I think that's another reason. Well, I'd heard it and wasn't completely sure I believed it, but I can vouch for that now. I've seen it myself. So yes, I think for those reasons, among others, we plumped for the Samsung as the F9000 as the 4K TV.
Awesome LED TV, irrespective of resolution. And rounding things off, it's the future, or we hope it's the future. It's the Samsung 55-inch OLED TV, the KE55S9C, which is, again, one you saw, and I haven't. Bastard.
Yeah,
so go on, Steve. What was it like?
Okay, I'm not a particularly big fan of curving the thing. Other than as a marketing gimmick, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. But in pure image quality terms, I've seen nothing that compares to it in terms of absolute black levels and sheer dynamic range. Image accuracy was superb. The only surprise really was that the motion handling wasn't as good as I was expecting, given the incredibly fast response times. It's like an LCD television, like an LCD panel. But yes, as a glimpse of the future and what's to come, it was very exciting. There's no question that once they get the price down, we're all going to be going for OLEDs in a big way. And obviously the ultimate holy grail is a 4K OLED. And hopefully we'll be seeing more of that at CES in January.
I'm sure we will. But do you think once 4K takes a hold and the increased frame rates are unlocked, do you think they'll change the motion processing with OLEDs? Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, certainly a possibility.
Rather than go for sample hogs.
Yeah,
rather than the sample and hold way, because as you said, it's just the same as existing LED LCD technology. But weren't you told by Samsung that they're doing it that way because people would find it unnatural otherwise?
Yes, that's what they told me.
I don't know whether to believe that, do you? But if so, that would possibly open up the possibility of them changing the motion processing for 4K at 60 frames per second. One can hope, anyway.
They've got they certainly have room to play with there in terms of the innate capabilities of the panel.
Yeah, the panel response times are ridiculously fast, aren't they?
So fast. You never know. And that's it for hardware news. We'll be back in a second with games news. Right, Mr. Bot, right, now it's your turn to in the limelight. YouTube, apparently, are culling games content for copyright.
Yes, there's a new flagging system for copyright infringement. Basically, they're scanning channels to look for copious amounts of gaming footage, and it's ended up basically flagging and blocking a lot of stuff, Let's Play videos, which are where people tend to play the first hour of a game or something like that with a general commentary along with it. But it's not just those kind of videos. It's also, we've seen some kind of comparison pieces. Some YouTube personalities like Angry Joe have had lots of flagged videos. And it's, people who rely upon these things for revenue from the ads that pop up and the like. And it just seems a little bit of an odd move, especially now that we've seen that there are a lot of publishers and developers who've essentially come out and said it wasn't us that instigated this.
Don't you think it's YouTube after more ad revenue? Because this is essentially free publicity for the developers, the games.
Yeah.
So don't you think they're chasing their money in the long run?
Yeah, I think that's probably the way that it's going. I mean, Nintendo had previously said they'd take a slice of advertising rather than block content use from their games. But it does seem a little bit odd. I mean, if you're going to play it along the lines purely of we're doing the right thing by the people who own the copyright and who produce this content to begin with, i.e. the original games, there are TV shows, there are movies, there are albums, there are songs. There's so much on virtually every kind of, streaming video service out there. It just does seem a bit like shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted. So I think they're on slightly shaky ground. And I think particularly being owned by Google and the whole do no evil thing has particularly kind of irked a lot of people because, I mean, this is a service, let's face it, that's taken off because it was quite lax. It's taken off not because it had strict guidelines. It's taken off because people could see anything and anything that you chose to think of that might have had, copyright issues, you could pretty much guarantee you could see it on YouTube straight away, even if it would be taken down after a week. That's where it would be hosted. So, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Whether they get any more ad revenue from it, whether it's a case of should we say, all publishers and developers banding together and just saying, no, it's free, carte blanche, and kind of us, opt out of that.
Do many of the developers have their own channels on YouTube?
I don't check that kind of thing, but I think, yeah, a lot of, I think the publishers tend to. I'm not sure about the developers.
I'm just wondering whether, you know, they could open up their own channels, invite people to upload videos, or that, I don't know if that would work or not.
Well, I think the problem is that, you know, particularly for the YouTube personalities and those kind of people, and, you know, Let's Play, they all want their own particular channels and the like.
Yeah.
And there has been a suggestion, I think it was Ubisoft said that it could be to do with the music that was also accompanying certain clips. I know some people use, you know, music in the background and the like, so there could be, you know, an issue with that. But it does seem like they've kind of applied this particularly aggressive robot algorithm, whatever you want to call it, to all the content on YouTube, and it seems to have particularly targeted gaming content.
I smell an ulterior motive, definitely.
A conspiracy.
Yeah, that's
in the world of technology. Well, I love
a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, Mark. Both Marks, in fact, there. And in other news, the Xbox One and the Xbox 360 are going to get original TV shows starting in early 2014.
Yes, Nancy Tellum, who's speaking to Variety, she's Microsoft TV executive, which is a post a lot of people might have said, that exists. Yes, it exists. She said early, or the reports are all coming out saying early 2014, but what she actually said was first quarter, or I think she said perhaps second quarter at a minimum, which doesn't seem to make much sense. But yeah, this is going to be premium content, so behind the paywall of Live. There are no real details as to what it is, but obviously they announced at the Xbox One event in May that there was a Halo TV show with Steven Spielberg down as executive producer. So that's obviously going to be a big driver of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's really not much. The details are scarce. I mean, she said they're not Netflix. She said, we aren't Amazon. We're a different animal. And they're still trying to work out the deals and all this kind of thing and talking
in
about...
In other words, they've got no clue about this sort of thing.
Just like everything else that they've been doing recently.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, she said, we're talking exclusive first windows, exclusive second windows. So it sounds like quite a kind of a mixed bag and trying to attract as much potential attention to it and get as many people to put their content on that service as possible. I mean, Games with Gold you've had as a kind of vague answer to Sony's PlayStation Plus, but obviously Microsoft want, if they're going to, should we say, dominate one market, which you assume would be America, would be what they were hoping for, they need lots of different types of content. You know, they need a good music service, they need a good TV service, and I think, you know, at the moment the trouble is that Netflix is basically taken off to such a huge degree, and there are so many other different streaming services out there. They need exclusive content. They need something that's going to drive people towards, you know, what they've got locked behind that paywall.
Can we assume it's going to be largely a TV series based upon their game material, or original stuff?
See, I really don't know. See, that's the weird thing about this, which is, on the one hand, you'd think, well, yes, perhaps it would be. I mean, Halo obviously being the big name that you can drop. But if you consider the fact that you're trying to attract people to buy into this paywall, to kind of unlock all this content, well, given the fact that Xbox Live allows you to play multiplayer games anyway, the people who would be interested in Halo, a predominantly multiplayer game, will already have paid for that. So therefore, you know, you're not making any great amount of extra money through those people because they've already paid their fee anyway. They're already actually playing Halo.
Yeah, I'm certainly not going to be laying out 40 quid a year to watch a Halo series.
No,
I've watched the...
It's not going to entice me into paying for a live subscription.
The movie they made is on Netflix already.
Absolutely awful.
Sure,
yes, exactly. It's not very good. And when you're talking about things like sci-fi, you know, related stuff like Halo, you know, you need to have production budgets that you consummate with delivering the kind of production values and effects that you'd expect from a feature like that. And that's expensive. So yeah, they're going to put the money into it? Or?
Well, again, this is the other issue, which is if kind of rumors are to be believed and that the gaming division is getting slightly squeezed and that, you know, perhaps people might consider at some point selling it off even. how much money do you put into this right now, considering the fact they've you know, the console is basically being made or being sold for a small profit, it seems. So therefore, how much money are you going to invest in some kind of service that you're going to entice people to, that you're hoping you'll make back that £40 a year and you'll guarantee that for, what, 5-6 years? You know, you've got to put in a huge amount to be producing those kind of big budget, decent series.
Yeah.
The only other alternative I could perhaps see would be, which is, as with Netflix, you know, picking up perhaps series that, I don't know, have been dropped, that have, you know, suitable fan appreciation, that kind of thing. Is there any way they could work with that?
Yeah, would the market be big enough to sustain that? I think Netflix has got that luxury, but I'm not sure Xbox TV will have.
And also Netflix, I mean, they produced some really quality homegrown content by basically attracting really, really good talent. I mean, people like David Fincher, for example, on House of Cards. I mean, that's been their key, I think, getting talent in. And the question is whether, I mean, obviously they've got Spielberg involved, so that's a good start for Microsoft. But, you know, it'll basically live or die on the kind of quality talent they can attract.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that services probably would be easier to attract people with. You know, anything that the kind of content portals rather than actually creating the content themselves. Because, I mean, just if you imagine what would be necessary to populate an entire Xbox TV channel.
You know, original content, it'd be impossible, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So therefore, you've got content that's already available through other means. You know, it's just, yeah, it sounds like they're a little bit late to the party. And, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they can make any decent inroads there.
A familiar story, then.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, both of the marks again. Ed, are you all right there? You still awake?
Yeah, no, I'm fine. I'm just trying to
suffocate.
Trying to get my head right. No. He's at the other end of the bed now. I don't know. I have to. It's just weird. I was reading this ahead of time, and I was just so far removed from something I'd spend money on as a Netflix subscriber, and I have to say, not a particularly committed online gamer, that I just. You've hit upon all the things that, you know, I think are relevant. I don't think it's going to bring new blood in. And it just strikes me as, it's going to be tremendously expensive to do it anything other than half-heartedly. And if they do it half-heartedly, no one's going to do it. So I don't understand it. But then again, there are a number of things I don't understand, which have gone on to be tremendously successful. So I don't know if I'm necessarily writing it off. We'll see what happens.
Well, that's it for the games news. Obviously, don't forget that the games podcast is now available to download and listen to. Mark, what did you discuss in this month's podcast?
In this, it was a slightly festive edition in that we touched upon Christmas at the end. But, generally, the new consoles, with everyone finally having had a good, you know, fortnight to a month with the Xbox One and PlayStation 4 and basically launch games and how we've been getting on with those.
Great, and I understand you were presenting it in the absence of Steve Hill with his bad back.
Yes, Steve's bad back, which seems to coincide with the fact that he's taken delivery of his Titan graphics card. Which there's perhaps that, or perhaps, you know, it reminds me of the time, you know, that my dad seemed to do his back that kind of coincided with when the test match was on, you know.
Oh, perhaps that's there's bloody, that. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Yes.
Don't even think about it, Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Buttright.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, I was standing host, but fingers crossed it went okay.
So, standing host for the Games podcast, and currently with me, the standing host for the weekly podcast. Although Phil will be back in the new year, you'll be glad to know, I'm sure.
We're dropping like flies.
Okay. Well, that's it for the games news. We'll be back in a second with the movie news.
You know what I want to know?
Yes, Mark, what would you like to know?
What's on the movies, Steve?
Well, Mark, this week it was The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. That's Smaug, not Smaug. Apparently I've been saying it wrong all these years. Which is obviously the second part in the decidedly unnecessary Hobbit trilogy. clearly...
That's the review done then.
Yeah. Yep. And thank you, and we'll move on. Clearly, the filmmakers have been listening to some of the criticism that they got last year with the first part, because certainly this is a far more serious film than the previous installment. A lot less singing and dancing and mucking about with dwarves. In fact, if you look at the marketing, the dwarves have taken a very big backseat here. In fact, Bilbo and Thorin barely get a look, and they've been pushing heavily Orlando Bloom and new characters like Bard and Toriel, who's an invented character, who's a female elf. And they've been pushing these, I think, trying to sort of connect more with the Lord of the Rings, because they've realized perhaps that people weren't completely satisfied with the first installment. They've also been very quiet on the subject of HFR. Obviously, last year when they released The Unexpected Journey, they had a lot of screenings in HFR. It's high frame rate, 48 frames a second. The feedback was largely not good. People felt it looked too much like video. It took them out of the experience. This year, only 20% of the screenings are in HFR. The majority are in 24 frames a second, either in 2D or predominantly 3D. I saw it at 24 frames a second in 3D. I would never, ever, if at all possible, ever see an HFR screening again. I just hated it beyond belief. So that at least made the film more bearable than last time round. Although, because he was shooting at 48 frames a second, Jackson was moving his camera an awful lot, which I don't think he would have done if he'd been shooting 3D at 24 frames a second. So I found it a slightly uncomfortable 3D experience because there was so much motion in the frame, although there's an awful lot of layering and the depth, and it was quite spectacular. And he certainly has an eye for 3D composition. I do think that he moved the camera far too much. In terms of the film itself, you know, make one film about The Hobbit, great. You could maybe stretch it to two films if you put in more stuff from the appendices in order to fill out, you know, where Gandalf was going to at various points and that kind of thing. Three films, that's just taking the piss. It really is clear that they are desperately struggling to pad this out as much as they possibly can to run it to three films. It just doesn't have enough story to do it. And every time they move away from the main thread of the book itself, you know, it's quite obviously, you know, detracting from the narrative structure of the film. There's just too many cutaways and too many pointless things being added in purely to... There's so many chase sequences. There's way too much Orlando Bloom. It's like, you know, instead of being a sort of pleasant cameo that you could enjoy, it becomes a starring role. And he's constantly just running after orcs and cutting their heads off and shooting them with arrows. The barrel escape sequence goes on forever. It looks like a theme park ride. There's way, way too much CGI. And it goes from being incredibly good CGI, like Smaug himself, who is a really well-realized digital character, to some really dodgy CGI. There's a bit where Orlando Bloom is just riding his horse that looks totally fake. And you're thinking, how can you make riding a horse look so fake? You know, although Orlando Bloom is not a great actor, maybe just his performance was a bit wooden. But yeah, it just feels like they're desperately trying to tie it in as much as possible with Lord of the Rings. So, for example, the film opens with the flashback sequence to the prancing pony where Gandalf meets Thorin. It's really not there for anything other than to tie the film in more with the Lord of the Rings. And it just feels like there's too much padding going on. And it ends on what I only describe as a very unsatisfactory cliffhanger where Smaug flies off basically to attack the lake town. And that's where it just sort of ends. And you're kind of thinking, well, at least in the Lord of the Rings movies, he structured them so there was a kind of a sort of an ending to each film that made it satisfying in its own right. But obviously, then there was more story to come. This just felt like it just stopped. And it wouldn't have happened if they stuck with a two-story structure where they could have ended it quite well and then gone into the second film.
How long is it, Steve?
It's actually, thank God, it's shorter than the previous one. So it's 160 minutes.
Still fairly long.
It's still a longish film, yeah. It's still a long film. I mean, the elements of it are great. As I said, Smaug is amazing. The voice of Benedict Cumberbatch works really well. The animation's great. Bilbo, Martin Freeman, is again very good, as is Gandalf, Ian McKellen. Bard, who's played by Luke Evans, is extremely good in it. And Evangeline Lilly, who was in Lost, who plays the new character, Toriel, who's an elf, she's very good in it too. So there's good performances in it. Some beautiful designs, some good effects and some not so good effects, but it's just too long. It's just you just felt it in there somewhere is a cracking movie, but I can't see it because of all this extra padding and unnecessary length. It's just pure greed of making it into three films because there's another $1 billion on the table, and unfortunately in doing so it's kind of destroyed a lot of the appeal of it. I mean, I'm a fan of the Middle Earth movies. I mean, I really love Lord of the Rings, and even I'm kind of sitting there thinking, like, this is too much of a good thing. I felt like a diabetic who's just gorged himself on chocolate, and now I need an insulin injection desperately. So, I give it 7 out of 10 because there are good elements to it, but you just feel like, finally, I know what they mean when they say you can have too much of a good thing.
More like a 6.5 then, really.
But we can't do halves.
No, we don't do halves.
We don't do halves, do we? No. So that's The Hobbit, Desolation of Smaug. It's opened on Friday, so if you want to go and see it, if you aren't seeing them right now. In terms of Blu-rays released this week, we have a trio from Arrow Films, Cinema Paradiso, Big Trouble in Little China, and The Long Goodbye, all three of which are currently on the site. They were reviewed, one by Chris. Chris did Big Trouble in Little China. He also did a massive, epic article about the film. Kaz reviewed The Long Goodbye, and Alan reviewed Cinema Paradiso, and all three of them give the discs high marks for picture quality and sound. They said they're absolutely superb restorations. They also give all three movies high marks, and I have seen all three films, and they are excellent. So certainly those three are worth checking out. And also, if you're a fan of 3D conversions, we've got Jurassic Park 3D and Predator 3D, both of which have come out on 3D Blu-ray this week as well. And as Mark pointed out last week when I got it wrong, this week we also see the release of One Direction, This Is Us.
Yay! Can I just say, with Big Trouble in Little China, I love that film. I love it. It's one of my favourites. And it would be natural for me to go and buy this Blu-ray, especially if they've typed. But half of the magic for me, the first time I saw it on the world's most worn out rental VHS. And in part, that's how it looks in my nostalgia-rific childhood. and yeah, if you now showed me it, you know, absolutely immaculate, I don't know if that would be right. Can you have too much of a good thing?
I know what you mean. Yeah, in some ways, that memory of how you first saw it is key to its enjoyment in a way. Although at £12, it's bloody good value for a Blu-ray, and it's got a commentary track with John Carpenter and Kurt Russell. That's it. Who are in real life genuinely good friends, and it's one of those really great commentary tracks where you just like you feel like you're sitting down with a couple of friends and they're just talking and laughing and telling anecdotes and stories about the film, and it's really, really good value. They've also got the two of them doing a commentary track on The Thing as well, which is equally as entertaining. So in some respects, it's worth getting the Blu-ray just for that. Who's eating a cracker in the background?
I thought it was someone playing the news.
Yeah, very. Kind of stony, gravelly sound if it was someone's nose.
It's nothing to do with me.
It wasn't me.
Right, okay, moving on.
Everyone just get pinned on me anyway. Yeah, well, it was saw you, what you did last week.
It was Ed.
Yeah.
You deserve scum.
It was you.
It wasn't me.
You admitted it at the time.
I don't know. I can't keep up these days. Yeah. I'm just old.
You're losing your heads, mate. Losing your heads.
Anyway, that's the Blu-ray releases for this week. Now, on to a story that you picked up on, Mark, which is, I believe, Netflix, who did a survey. And are we becoming a nation of binge watchers?
This is something we've talked about, I think, numerous times before. But the rise of Netflix has not only created a new phrase into the popular culture, which was a runner-up to the word selfie as the word of 2013, which was a binge watcher. So that's categorized by anyone that watches more than one episode at a time, basically 2 to 6 episodes on the spin of a TV show, and they did some research into this and found out of all their subscribers, I'm just searching for the numbers wildly now because I wasn't expected to come to 76% of all those Netflix subscribers asked are self-confessed binge watchers. And they say it's nothing. We shouldn't be ashamed of it. We shouldn't be ashamed of our habits.
Yeah, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Of course they say that. Yeah, I'm in agreement.
Gentlemen, can I just say this? My name is Stephen Withers, and I'm a binge watcher.
Well, I am too, but this is still like crack dealers saying, buy our sweet, refreshing crack. Yeah, it's absolutely excellent.
It's only £6 a month, and it's not going to kill you. So I think it does raise the immersion level, the levels of immersion when you're watching TV series back to back. On your recommendation, I'm watching The Killing, and that's terrible. That's really bad for wanting to know what happens next. Really, really bad. So I've done.
Can I just say another thing cropped up over the weekend? Yeah. One of the most underrated TV series, mainly because in the UK it's only shown on Channel 5, which obviously does tend to turn people off a bit. But the first season of Person of Interest has appeared on Netflix. And anyone that didn't watch that, just give it a go. I think it's bloody excellent.
I've no idea what that is.
Massively.
I was wondering about that, Ed. Thank you. I'll have to check it out.
I love it. Yeah. I'm going to say, yesterday My name is Ed, and I was also binge watching because it was like, yes!
Yeah, I see. So we actually posted this on the forums. We've got some interesting replies about people's binge watching habits.
I dread to think. Well, go on, Mark.
No, there's nothing indecent here. We make us look like amateurs, basically. Some people have done entire 24, was it on Facebook or on here? Entire 24 in 24 hours. So literally back to back, they watched the entire first season of 24 in
actually,
one go.
It takes 18 hours because I did it.
Yeah, once. I guess we've allowed
take out the toilet breaks
and food and whatnot. That is some commitment. Although they don't necessarily recommend it, which I think is probably a bit much.
How did Netflix actually define their binge watching with regards to the amount of people who...
You weren't listening, were you?
Two
to six episodes in a go is the definition of binge watching.
I mean, two is a very low threshold.
Two's not. It's not a binge watching.
Yeah,
it's a half an hour.
It's an aperitif, isn't it?
That's really lightweight if you're only watching that, to be honest.
I mean, to be fair, there are some Iron Man binge watching things that I don't know if anyone's tried this. I know that there were some people on the forum mentioned it when the final extended edition of Lord of the Rings, the Return of the King, was released. So I know a couple of people sat down and watched all of them back to back.
Yep, I've done
which
that.
Which is pretty
that.
Significant. But I mean, that's you're basically watching three reasonable films. I think that someone ought to do the Police Academy marathon. They have to do all seven. And
it
let's face it,
after the first.
You're starting with a film which is, you know, lovable in its own right, and then you just have to wade into a sea of relentless mediocrity, winding up with Mission to Moscow, which is one of the worst films ever made.
That should probably be some sort of criminal punishment, I think.
Yeah. Or maybe some sort of CIA torture program.
Yeah.
I have done Lord of the Rings extended cuts in one sitting. That took well over 12 hours. I think it'd be 14.
Genuine one sitting, or did you allow yourself any breaks?
Well, I went for toilet breaks and got snacks and things. I didn't like sit there with a catheter in me and a bag under my ass.
Lightweight.
I've done all six Star Wars films in a single day. And this was a bit of a struggle towards the end, all five Planet of the Apes movies. In a day.
Oh, dear.
And I've got to say, by the time I got to Battle for the Planet of the Apes, I was getting a bit bored. That was definitely a long one. But
I think with DVD box sets, you kind of set yourself up for these things. But with the likes of Netflix, it kind of just happens. Especially with...
It creeps up on you, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially with the auto start of the next episode. And you think, oh, go on.
Yeah. Next episode starts in 19 seconds. Are your eyes bleeding?
The press start. Yeah.
I just see Mark sitting there scratching his arm, stiffly going like, just one more. Just one more. That's all. Just one more little fix. That's all. Just
3 a.m. Do you have to go to bed yet? But yeah, I've got one more episode of The Killing left, Ed, so I guess I'm in for a big disappointment tonight.
Well, no, you can just kick off on Person of Interest.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true.
Okay. And good news for you, Mark, and me, come think about it. Netflix will be showing Just Call Saul.
Just Call Saul, spin-off to Breaking Bad. Yeah, they announced it a while back, but they've confirmed that we were getting it at some point in 2014 and before US Netflix. So we'll get it after they've aired on the US networks. So, which is Saul was an excellent character, big comedy character in Breaking Bad. Yeah, love Saul. So, be interesting to see. It's kind of a prequel, so it's set before his time with Hank and Jesse. But yeah, great character. Vince Gilligan's involved, like his executive producing, so it sounds promising. And with Netflix behind it, I think it's going to be good.
Okay, excellent. That's good news. And talking of Netflix and our viewing habits particularly, obviously Christmas is coming up next week. Now, I don't know about you guys, but when I was a kid, I would get the Radio Times and at one point the TV Times before they had them both in the Radio Times. And I would basically sit down and plan out all the films I was going to watch over that 2-week Christmas period, you know, and make a note of everyone, what time they were on, what I was going to see. Because basically that was when the big movies got their premieres on TV, was over the Christmas period. And I would literally spend that 2-week period off school watching a shed load of television. Was I the only one doing that, or did you guys do that as well?
No, we did the same thing. Definitely planned it out, but not necessarily for the full 2 weeks, but certainly over the sort of the busy period when all the blockbusters were on, get the video set and all the rest of it. But yeah, the Radio Times was an essential. Now I never even give it a second thought to buy it.
You've got to pick up the Christmas edition of Radio Times, surely.
It's £3.25.
No, I haven't but it's got that the
bump,
in years.
It's got the bumper crossword in there.
Oh, see, the TV crossword at the back, that is good, actually, to be fair.
Ed,
can't you do it online, then?
No, it's a prize, cryptic crossword.
Oh, is it cryptic? Oh, no, you're enticing me now. I'm having it.
Yeah.
I won't read that in the TV series. I will do the crossword at the back.
Sound almost orgasmic, then, at the thought of the crossword.
I love a cryptic.
You were a big crossword. Oh, okay. Ed, you're a bit younger than us. Did you do that with the Radio Times?
No, mainly because my parents, I don't think a single copy of the Radio Times ever appeared in the house. My parents for years have always used the Times Culture. It comes on a Sunday. It always has the week's guide going forward. And I don't think it mapped it out in quite the same way. So maybe I was just missing out. But I seem to remember the vast majority of my sort of Christmas holiday period was it was a bit different for me. I mean, I was away at boarding school, which was pretty much free of television and in many ways, more importantly, computer gaming. I'd just come back and just play, you know, Rick Dangerous and Supercars 2 until my eyes bled. I didn't actually watch that much television over Christmas. And then normally on after Christmas, there'd be additions to either the computer gaming or similar. And that would be taking my attention instead. So I mean, obviously when they do these roundups of greatest Christmas TV moments, and I suddenly realize I've seen very few of them. And sometimes I feel bad about that, but more often than not, I feel better about that because most of them are just awful.
At least you don't get to watch them again. At least it's the first time you've seen them.
Yeah, that's true. What about you, Mr. Boltwright?
For me, it was generally Christmas specials, not as much the films, lots of video games, and yeah, just look at which of the kind of. It was always the Christmas specials with some kind of a bizarre twist or something like that. You know, the kind of shows that perhaps hadn't been on for a couple of years, and then you were getting some kind of a celebrity walk-on cameo or something ridiculous like that. But beyond that, no, I'm afraid it was, you know, video games.
I should probably point out for our younger listeners, if we've got any younger listeners, that obviously this is back in the days when there were only four channels. There was no Netflix, there was no DVDs, there were no Blu-rays. Even sell-through videotapes was pretty much unheard of back then. You could just rent them. So, you know, if you were a movie fan, this was the only way, and obviously films would go on at the cinema and then that would be it, that you wouldn't see them again at the cinema, they wouldn't get re-released. So the only way you were going to watch some of these big movies was when they were broadcast on network television over a holiday season. Maybe you could record the broadcast, obviously, and then watch it again later. But that was basically your only access. If you were a movie fan in the sort of 80s, that was your only access in the late 70s. It was your only access to the big movies at the time, you know, and obviously, things have changed substantially since then. But I kind of, in a strange way, I feel nostalgic about it. It was quite exciting. I mean, getting the Radio Times, because you didn't know what was going to be on at Christmas. Yeah. That was really exciting, going through it to find out what films were actually being broadcast. And then trying to work out how you could schedule yourself around them. I mean, scheduling everything. Christmas lunch, okay, when's the big film on? The big Bond movie on Christmas Day.
See, I've got to say, Christmas films in a strange way, perhaps it's just me, but it seems to have almost taken the sheen off so many films that previously I liked.
You know, because due to repetition.
Yeah, there are some films that I would rather watch of an evening, you know, for some reason, you know, putting on like a decent James Bond film in the afternoon when you're kind of sat stupefied over Christmas, it just seems wrong. It just seems wrong to have, you know, a perfectly worked vision of spy atmosphere broken up by a family argument in the background.
True.
I don't know. Christmas Day films never featured for us. There's in the mornings, you know, you did traditional Christmas things. There was spot of breakfast, opening presents, retreat for lunch, and then it was competitive board gaming. Television wasn't on for that. It would degenerate into an orgy of bitterness and recrimination by about 6:30, and then when we were quite young, obviously my brother and I would have been awake since sort of 4, and it would just like pass out by that stage. And actually, my dad wouldn't be too far behind by that point. And then when we're a bit older, yeah, it must be said, if anyone is looking for a game, Christmas game, to sort of break up the tedium, I have just received, it arrived today, my copy of Cards Against Humanity. And I am really looking forward to playing
Cards
that.
Against Humanity.
It's a game called Cards Against Humanity.
A board game. So, like, playing cards, taking over the planet or something like that?
Well, basically, it's a big box of cards, and then you pull out a white card, which is effectively either a question or a start of a phrase statement. And then each person takes a black card, and the winner is the person whose black card is the best answer. Now, that doesn't sound too appealing, so at the moment I'm frantically typing and I'm going to ping a link.
Yeah, I've got to say, Ed, that doesn't sound remotely appealing. You lost me about 10 minutes ago.
Well, the fact that it's called Cards Against Humanity might tell you that it's not in the best possible taste, so hang on a second.
What long winter evenings must just fly by at your house.
Look, trust me on this. All right.
Hang on a second.
I've sent the link through. So effectively, the link I've just sent. So the black question is blank, hours of fun, easy to use and perfect for. And the winner was the person that had questions that the two white cards that turned it into the entire internet. Hours of fun, easy to use, perfect for a cat video so cute that your eyes roll back into your your eyes roll back and your spine slides out your anus. Then, for example, then more depressing to that, drink to forget blank, white card, drinking alone. And, it just carries on like that. It's hard to describe, but honestly, it's fantastic fun, although it is a bit risque. So, depending on how your parents are. So, there's, for example, gentlemen, on the list I've just sent, the number 11 is going to be amusing if that's actually in the UK version of the game. And I am playing it with my parents.
It looks a little bit like a vulgar blankety blank.
It is.
Do you get a checkbook and pen in? Yeah.
So, in other words, black card, what did the US airdrop to the children in Afghanistan? Answer, a lifetime of sadness.
All right. Thank you for that, Ed. Thank you for that. Since you brought up, is this a Christmas present for somebody? Or you just bought it for yourself? All right. Okay. Right. Well, since you brought up Christmas presents, and we've already discussed presents of the past, presents of the present, let's talk about presents of the future. The Christmas ghosts of technology yet to come. What would you actually like to get in your stocking at some point in the future? And I'm going to kick this off because there's two things. One is genuinely might happen, hopefully. The other one probably not so much. Well, 4K Blu-ray.
Yeah, of course.
I want that desperately, and I'm really hoping that gets announced at CES, because I think that's the key to any kind of mass acceptance of 4K as a display technology. But the other thing that I really want, and I guess this will be for Christmas 2015, is a Mattel hoverboard, like in Back to the Future Part 2. Where are they? What happened to them?
You see what? Gents? From Back to Future 2, that's the thing that you want, not say a Mr. Fusion. A giant two-fingered salute to the energy companies. Sod you, I'm powering my house on household waste.
But it's no good if there's no fuel in the car. When there's run out of gas, they're still buggered, aren't they? As they found out in the third part. It only powered the flux capacitor, not the internal combustion engine.
All right, that's great. But I don't know. I wanted a time machine as well.
Can't you get hoverboards? Not like to the extent, but they're actually
anti-gravity hoverboards generally are not available to the public.
They've got some blowers, it's like kind of like a hovercraft kind of idea.
I want the ones like in the film where they fly around.
But here's my question, Steve.
You'll be dead before that happens, mate.
Steve. Steve.
Yes, Mark.
Can you ride a skateboard?
Now, that is the slight flaw in the plan.
I was going to say, just because it's got no wheels doesn't mean you can use it.
I cannot ride one well, if that's what you're asking. No, I've fallen off more times than I say on it. I had one when I was a kid, when the first craze hit in the 70s, after begging my parents, and they made me wear the bloody elbow pads and knee pads and a helmet because I was going to kill myself. And I probably would have killed myself too. But yes, not recently. I haven't ridden one though. But still, come on. Wouldn't you want a hoverboard if it was available?
Honestly, I preferred the shoes that did themselves up.
Well, you were able to buy those, weren't you?
Well, you could buy a design that looked like them, but they didn't do themselves up.
Run of,
It's not the same.
Yeah, Phil. there was a guy beneath the set pulling the strings, pulling the, you
know. No!
You're joking.
Places now. apparently, Robert Zemeckis did actually say at the time of Back to the Future Part 2 that Mattel had developed a hoverboard, but they weren't allowed to release it to the public because it was too dangerous.
Lethal.
And kids believed him and were writing and going, oh, where's the hoverboard? Right, that's me. What about most of you? Mark Hodgkinson.
Right, well, you took my first one, 4K Blu-ray player, but it might be reality. I've only got two more things. And that's a non-reflecting TV, so a TV that doesn't reflect back any light. And these are on the way as well.
That already exists, Moth Eye.
No, it doesn't quite. It does reflect some, doesn't it?
Yeah, pretty good.
So, I mean, a completely non-reflecting TV.
Well, and the tent, a black hole.
yeah. But they're working on glass that's so multi-layered and then just offset at angles that it doesn't actually reflect, or not perceptibly to the human eye. So I'd love to see one of those. And some kind of child shutter-upper. Sorry, I've just kids just shouted in the background. An automated ironing system of some description where you could just I don't do a lot of ironing, but sometimes I have to. She's not here all the time.
Virtual.
And I hate ironing and I'm rubbish.
You see, I find it quite therapeutic.
Oh no, vacuuming I like, but not ironing. No.
I think apparently LG might have an automatic ironing system.
Do they? Well, they can send it over here and I'll review it. I'm not sending it back.
Unreliable source.
It's the kind of thing I can imagine them working on, but I think there's got to be safety concerns about that kind of
thing. Corby trouser press. That's what you should get yourself for Christmas.
Yeah, but that doesn't work for everything, does it?
And it's also not a future technology. It's been around for years, but it's certainly quite
something a bit more. A bit more
in hotel rooms.
Robotic than that. That would come in useful for those rare occasions when I have to wield an iron. Other than that, I'm quite happy with.
I was massively impressed by LG's washing machine that didn't use any water.
Yeah, that's handled that.
Which is incredibly clever.
What was this?
yeah. Used spirits. He came out smelling like a pissed Scottish wino. not for the first time, yeah. Mr. Botwright, what about you?
Virtual reality gaming that cuts down on motion sickness. Anything like that, I would be happy with. Whether that ends up being an Oculus Rift with an omnidirectional treadmill or whatever Sony's potential answer might be, anything like that would be A-OK by me.
I've seen so many of those headsets from Sony that I've never seen to appear in any of the shops.
Yeah, I've asked for review samples. I've never sent one.
No.
Which leads me to think they're rubbish.
You think your virtual reality... Well, they're not rubbish because I've tried them out and they look quite good, but... I think they're just not very cheap, are they? And therefore, no one's ever going to buy them.
Didn't you have to lie down to what was the first generation of them?
The one I saw
they kept slipping off your head otherwise. Okay.
They were. I think they can, some sort of hat thing might come in order then.
Sort of elastic sort of contraption.
But Mr. Botwright, what about, so you've got your VR set up, would you get like a groinal attachment somewhere to make it really immersive? Because you're not going to go out much by the sounds of it. You're not even going to walk anymore. You're going to stand on a treadmill.
No. They're still walking. You're on the treadmill.
Girlfriend.
Now, see, you're playing into a stereotype again, Steve. I don't know.
I know, but you know what? About stereotypes, they're usually true. That's why they become stereotypes, in my experience. Right, and saving the best, obviously, to a last, because he's usually got something ridiculous up his sleeve, literally and metaphorically. Ed Selly. What are you looking forward to in the future?
I want to take Botwright's idea and run with it. I want a holodeck from Star Trek. I mean, admittedly, you'd never see or hear from me ever again. I mean, what possible reason would be there for me to return to the real world if I actually had one?
I'll tell you a reason, Ed. You walked into the wall. How does a holodeck actually work? Because it's still a finite space.
I don't... Do you think I give the slightest concern.
Can't they just move the floor?
As it worked.
Well, wouldn't everyone be moving at the same time? It wouldn't work. It just doesn't, it makes no sense at all.
It has to, effectively, any time when there's more than one person in it, it's clearly going to run into some serious issues. But I don't care. I wouldn't want anyone else in it, you know, because frankly, you all disgust me and I'd be in my own little world and it would be fantastic.
It'd be like in Red Dwarf when they're all playing Better Than Life.
Yeah, Better Than Life.
Stop the game.
Absolutely.
You're going to look for the Planet of the Nymphos.
Oh, I don't care. I'd probably start Worthy. and wind up in a couple of months' time starved to death in a puddle of my own bodily fluid. So, you know, that's by the by. On a more
that's my average weekend, to be honest.
On a more prosaic note, I have to say I had to pop out to Maplin's earlier on. I had to buy a new router for the upstairs network. And I was just stuck in traffic. And what I'd love, obviously, we've seen all the stuff about Google self-driving cars. And it very genuinely looks like it's going to be a piece of technology that happens and happens in the foreseeable future. But everyone seems to be bolting it into just the most appallingly dull and worthy cars. I want it as a bolt-on attachment to the car of my choice. So if I want to have a 1973 Porsche 911, you know, back before they ruined them with all the big bumpers and stuff like that, I just like to have, completely seamless to the way the car looks, a bolt-on Google self-driving edition. So it's like, actually, do you know what? I can't be bothered. I'd like to go to the pub and get ruined, but my self-driving car will get me home after I've done that, so I can drive up to the pub looking cool and not like I'm driving a Toyota Prius with a rotating biscuit tin on the roof. I can look drive up looking cool, and I can be driven away inebriated, safe as houses, no risk to anyone else, and I'm still driving a cool car. That would be awesome. Genuinely awesome. Because I'm just worried that with the self-driving car, it'll just be like the Johnny Cabs in the original Total Recall. It'll just be awful.
Okay, I can see the definite appeal of a car that can drive you home when you've had a few too many. That definitely sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
Because taxis are bloody expensive.
You still get pulled over, though.
Why?
Because you can't be in a car with your keys if you're blind drunk. You're the only person in it.
What happens if you're sat in the passenger seat?
You can still get done. People have been done
for. The vehicle.
That is true. But clearly, asleep. They'd have to change the law.
They're going to change the law for Google. I don't know.
I can see that happening.
We're in Minority Report territory now.
Yeah, pre-crime. That's quite handy.
Oh, I don't know. It's just a nice idea. I just don't want it to be that by the time you can buy a self-driving car, it's just basically a milk float. And it's like,
Oh, Ed, they're all going to be milk floats when the oil runs out, so get used to it.
Shut it. I'm going to be a quality road warrior, or at least I'll pretend to be one in my holiday.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, actually, I could just simulate whichever car I like on the holiday and actually be just done with it.
True. Yeah, you
know, yeah. Make it self-driving. Just do what you want.
Yeah,
and you wouldn't even really need that anymore, do you? Thank you, gentlemen. Right, that's it for this week's podcast. One more to go before the end of the year, which will be our Christmas special, and also at the same time our Christmas party. That's how sad we are, but we'll do it live to all of you. You know, it's basically it's going to be our Christmas party. There'll be a couple of mince pies at each venue, but wherever we're all spread across the country recording from. Glass of sherry or two, possibly. Ed's got some extremely strong German beer lined up. I think maybe some absinthe later on in the podcast too.
We'll see.
Could get interesting. But for the moment, that's it for the AV4ones podcast for this week. My thanks to Mark Bodright.
A nutless monkey could do your job.
Thank you very much, Mark. That's the nice thing. Mark Hodgkinson.
I don't read the script. The script reads me.
And Ed Sully.
Man, I don't drop character until I've done the DVD commentary.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Bookmark avforums.com for the latest reviews, news, and videos. Plus, why not leave us a rating on iTunes if, as Ed pointed out last week, you enjoyed the show. But perfectly not if you didn't. I'm Steve Withers. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.